In a moment, a look at the new Democratic platform by commentators Gore Vidal and William Buckley. The main source of contention on the floor of the convention tonight is the Vietnam plank of the newly published Democratic platform. I would like to ask our guest commentators if they can find any serious differences between what the Republicans said about Vietnam and what the Democrats say about it. To my mind, I see very little difference. Our guests are the playwright Gore Vidal, a Democrat, a former candidate for Congress from New York State, and William Buckley, editor, and a former candidate for mayor of New York City. Mr. Buckley, will you begin?
I think that the important difference, Mr. Smith, is not in the planks as they were finally written, but in the effort that went into their composition. The Democrats, a great many of them, are clearly displeased with the plank insofar as it doesn't call immediately for an unconditional end in bombing. We know that Mr. McGovern and Mr. McCarthy joined forces to demand nothing less than that, the unconditional end bombing. There were no equivalent forces in the Republican Party, so that, although they ended up saying roughly the same thing, one is entitled to suppose that in the case of the Republicans, this truly represents the sentiment of the overwhelming majority of them, which is not the case concerning the Democrats.
I think that's well observed. There's a definite split here tonight. I personally favored, as many people did, the McCarthy-McGovern plank. I was just told the latest hot rumor here at the convention hall that the plank was given to Lyndon B. Johnson himself, who rewrote it and sent it back, and that is the one that they are now celebrating down on the floor. We were just given bits and pieces of this platform, and my favorite little bit here is, we strongly support the Paris talks and applaud the initiative of President Johnson, which brought North Vietnam to the peace table. Well, of course, it was Senator McCarthy in New Hampshire and the enormous movement of a great many people in the United States that caused our leader to make that diplomatic gesture. So I would say that the difference between the two platforms is, as Mr. Buckley suggests, the Republicans are pretty united in being not only on the one hand hawkish, but on the other hand, they seem to feel that they're open for negotiation, trying to relive, I suppose, the days of the Korean settlement by General Eisenhower, who talked very tough in the campaign and then, of course, made a peace with Korea. I suspect that may well be the Nixon plan. Meanwhile, you have a very divided Democratic Party here tonight.
What can the Republicans do that the Democrats can't if Nixon is elected, Mr. Buckley?
Well, if Nixon is elected, it seems to me that the forces in North Vietnam will know that his election certifies to the strategic seriousness of our anti-communist position there. That is to say, that he won't be hampered by a divided party, some of which, perhaps even the majority of which, is bitterly opposed, as Mr. Vidal quite correctly suggest to this policy. I do think, though, that Mr. Dow's diagnosis is insufficient, primarily for the reason that he doesn't take into account extrinsic circumstances. For instance, Eisenhower's peace on Korea may very well, as Democratic Chairman Paul Butler pointed out at the time, have also had something to do with the death of Stalin, which conveniently took place 2 or 3 months after Eisenhower's election. But also, one has to bear in mind that there have been such sentimentalities as calling for a coalition government, as calling for sending blood to the Viet Cong, all that kind of business, which have considerably hampered the negotiations which might otherwise have taken place more speedily.
Well, I think Mr. Buckley has given us a preview of what we will hear from the Republicans on this subject. I'd like to introduce a note that absolutely nobody has so far in the Vietnam debate, and that is that I happen to favor sort of diplomacy in the grand old style. I'm sure Mr. Buckley will agree with me, since he too is a lover of the Congress of Vienna and Metternich policy, that we should, since Ho Chi Minh is the enemy of Mao Tse-tung, therefore we should support Ho Chi Minh. Mao Tse-tung is the enemy of the Kremlin, therefore in certain cases we should support him. And the Kremlin is, of course, the enemy of Mao Tse-tung, and we should support them. Now this is grand politics. This is not ideological. It's not as interesting as the Holy War, as the fascinating war that we are the forces of life and we must destroy all other governments. But it has always been traditional in the conduct of foreign policy until the pietisms of John Foster Dulles, who really did believe, at least as far as we can tell, that we were indeed the forces of light and they were night, that we began forcing our way into the world and forever setting up this pietistic view that governments we disapproved of should be dealt with harshly. So I'm simply saying, to the extent that the leader of North Vietnam is no friend of China, this is not a monolithic conspiracy, we should support him. And by the same token, Mao Zedong, and again in this Viennese congressional circle. Mr. Buckley, would you like to add to that?
Well, Mr. Dow's suggestion that perhaps it would be in our interest to support Ho Chi Minh suggests perhaps also that as a matter of testamentary integrity, I reveal a concrete proposal to that end contained in a letter sent to me by Senator Kennedy about 6 months ago, the pièce of which was, I have changed my platform for 1968 from let's give blood to the Viet Cong to let's give gore of a doll to the Viet Cong.
May I see that, really?
I think, however, that would be immoderate. In any case, I do share Mr. Kennedy's notion that Mr. Vidal's idea of how to prosecute the whole situation out there, quite apart from the fact of a congruence of general policy, is marred by his sort of strange fantasies concerning the realisms of politics.
I must say, I'm looking at this, what a very curious handwriting. It all sort of slants up, kind of a manic depressive.
Did you say that about Senator Kennedy?
I did see that. Whether you forged it or not, I don't know, and I will have to have my handwriting expert, the graphologist, will have to look at it. I put nothing beyond you, not since the Dreyfus case, and we had such evidence brought into court. But it's very, very amusing and has nothing to do with the case. The fact that he was writing his letters makes me terribly suspicious of him as a presidential candidate. I will say that.
I'm not
talking
about the actual fact, you know. This is Senator Bobby Kennedy.
Yes, I realize. I recognize the handwriting.
Mm-hmm. I think
he had some notes about you.
Makes
me
suspicious.
Yes,
uh-huh.
Makes me very suspicious what he might have been like, president. But to get back to the plank, it's been fun inspecting your correspondence, but that what matters here is that we have, in a word, lost the war, and I think that was really the impression that the McCarthy-McGovern people have been trying to give the country, that we must get out of this. It cost us $100 billion. It cost us 25,000 dead. It has cost us something like 90% of the casualties are civilians. So when they accuse us of genocide, they are not without point.
Now, wait a minute.
We have nothing to gain by this war.
Now, wait a minute. The activity of the United States in North Vietnam cannot be categorized as genocide by anyone who doesn't accept the postulates of the Communist Party. Their postulates being, of course, that we are interested in killing people for the sake of killing people, the distinction being how many people is it necessary to kill in order to pursue a perfectly legitimate military mission, a distinction that has been honored during the past 1,000 years. But we have not lost the war in Vietnam. What we have lost is an opportunity to press that war with such weapons as are especially at our disposal. And the reason we haven't is because we have proceeded schizophrenically, make love to the communists this side of the hemisphere, hate them and kill them this side of the hemisphere. And this doesn't.
Well, now, what
sense.
Do you favor? Do you favor just an all-out war on communism, using nuclear weapons, as you have in the past, on the Chinese nuclear capacity?
Have
you
I also favored?
Yes, indeed. And something marvelous called a blow for peace. You came out, you said, quote, to give a two-hour notice to the Red Chinese that we intend to destroy these nuclear facilities and so give the civilian, military, and scientific population a chance to evacuate the plants, which we will then proceed, pure and simple, to blow up.
Yeah, why,
this
why
is a great statesman sitting here on my right.
Weapons?
That is an act of war.
Why would nuclear weapons? I never said nuclear weapons. I blew them up with poison ivy, for all I'm concerned. The point is...
Oh, well what is the difference?
It's
an act of war.
No, well,
it's an act of war.
Mr. Vidal.
To drop bombs on another country.
If you want
an act of war.
Change what you finished saying a moment ago. I will welcome any change at any point in here.
But you
said a moment ago that I favored nuclear bombing in Red China. For the record, I did not.
No,
I
for favored, the record, you said bombing.
I favored alongside a number of very serious military strategists, a preemptive strike against the nuclear facilities of Red China.
And you expect
a position to be taken seriously?
A position which was explored by President John F. Kennedy in the fall of 1963.
There was,
and could be thought of by all serious people who not only are against a nuclear bomb in the cafe society,
but
if you are trying to do something about it. If the bad guys have got the nuclear bomb,
much better when you don't talk at the same time. Could we take turns?
Yes, but I would like to just
pick up
that point.
Yeah.
I would like to pick up that point. You did indeed once to drop bombs on China, which is a foreign country of enormous size. It is no business of ours, I should think, to begin a Pearl Harbor, give them a Pearl Harbor. You have also advocated the invasion of Cuba and what you call the immediate enactment of the Monroe Doctrine, something I suspect you have never read because the Monroe Doctrine ceased to exist, in fact, since 1970. The Monroe Doctrine, for your information, happens to be dependent upon foreign powers in the United States. In this hemisphere, we're not to be allowed, but by the same token, we would maintain ourselves outside European affairs. We abrogated that by going to the First World War. So, in effect, the Monroe Doctrine does not exist.
Mr.
Dow, in this case,
it is a laborious job to straighten out history after you've had a couple of sentences go at it. The distinction was that we would not go to Europe except at the invitation of Europe. If you will give me the name of one country in Europe where we are without the invitation of the local government, then I will say that we have violated the equivalent of the Monroe Doctrine.
But the Monroe Doctrine is perfectly clear.
How do we get out of the war in Vietnam?
I've not read it.
Yes. The discussions about the plank in Vietnam. How do we get out? Have we really been beaten?
The answer is that we have not been beaten, Mr. Smith. The answer is that we are negotiating in Paris at this moment because the enemy feels the pressure of a 4-5 year effort by the United States and South Vietnam and certain of its Asian allies. It's not this simply because Senator McCarthy got 43,000 votes in New Hampshire. This isn't the way Haiphong works, Hanoi works. We can, of course, win the war, but it's going to take a concerted effort, and it's going to take the kind of implacable will which we seem to be lazily incapable of generating as a result of the kind of erosion of purpose to which people like Mr. Dahl contribute, sometimes eloquently, sometimes not.
I still don't see how Mr. Buckley, with his concerted will, thinks that we're going to win a war that we've spent certainly 5 very aggressive years in losing. We have tried search and destroy. We have dropped more bombs on it than we dropped on Europe in the Second World War. We are getting absolutely nowhere. They have a perfect desire to organize their own country in their own way, and there's no problem about it.
We are
in the presence, however, if I may say so, of, I would suspect, the most war-minded person in the United States. And usually Mr. Buckley doesn't reveal himself as clearly as he has tonight. But indeed, he has come out for a preemptive strike against Red China.
I came out for
an act of war. You came out for it in 1964, December 29th, at the National Review. You do write your own columns, don't you?
I said Mr. Kennedy in 63. I came out in 1964.
You were a little slow.
He considered it in 63.
It's a difference between consideration and opposing it.
The point is, Mr. Dow, that there are those people who are always deploring what ought to have been done back when certain other people were saying it should have been done at that moment. Now, one of these days, you're going to sit around shaking and talking about better red than dead because Red China has a hydrogen bomb. And the answer will be, who was it who a few years ago thought that might have been the time, as, for instance, in Munich, to stop appeasement? I don't say that life is going to be completely easy, completely non-dangerous.
We are, however,
very dangerous.
I know
there are very bad people.
I know that you're very interested in Munich and interested in the past. And of course, every decision you would have made correctly had you been in, asked.
Everyone I can recall.
You were not.
Everyone I can recall.
Yeah. Well, somehow the good judgment of the country maintained itself. And here we are today, and you're talking in the vaguest of terms, saying, now we're going to win in Vietnam. Now I assume that you are for escalation.
I said we could win.
We must.
I said we could, Mr. Vidal.
Could we or should we?
Oh, well, obviously, we should.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that's all we needed to know. Now, here he sits. Take a good look at the leading warmonger in the United States. Bill, don't you point your tongue at me now. Keep it in your cheek where it belongs.
Well, if I'm the leading warmonger in the United States, then I am to be contrasted with you in the sense in which the majority of the people of the United States, including the leadership of the Democratic Party and the leadership of the Republican Party, belong with me, while you go to Rome
Expatriate yourself.
I do not. I think we should straighten this out now. I don't expatriate myself. I have an apartment in Rome, and I go there for 2 or 3 months every year to be close to the Vatican and to contemplate William Buckley and his mad activities back here.
And
with enormous serenity, they're trying to get us, Bill.
Yes, and you published in January of this year in a book the following statement: unless the war in Vietnam is renounced by the next elected president of the United States, I see no moral alternative than to renounce my citizenship, dash, Vidal.
I think you said,
though, that we may not have anything to lose at the end of this election.
It may very well be that all that we can earn is our conscience. I must say it must be mysterious to you to find somebody acting out of a moral principle, but after all, sooner or later, we must all be confronted with these Sir Thomas More decisions, and I'm sure that you will settle for Wales and I for the block.
The Encyclopedia of Morality, which constitutes your published work, is hardly my primary source.
You read. Mr. Vidal, would it have been possible for any other president to have behaved differently in a decisive way from the way President Johnson did, say, in 1965? We have two ex-presidents, one a Republican, one a Democrat, who both say he's right. The dead president said 2 months before his death that he believed in the domino theory and felt that we should not let South Vietnam fall to the communists.
I have a strange feeling that empires have their own built-in dynamism. And you may be right that with the kind of presidents that we tend to have now, who reflect the mood of a country, that it may very well be this empire of ours has been going on since 1899, when we picked, remember, the Maine, which was as phony as the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. We've been in the empire business since 1899. We picked a war with Spain. We ended up with the Philippines, which we then liberated against their will and added to our empire. We became a great Pacific power. We tried an invasion of Canada. We talked from Mexico.
Are you with all of history?
I think you could learn a great deal.
I know,
and
but not
at the end of it,
time.
And at the end of it, we are now on the mainland of Asia. And I think, to be perfectly bleak and to be perfectly blunt, I think we're headed for a total disaster, this empire, with people like Mr. Buckley here beating the drum. And I think the instinct of the people, I used to think, was for peace. I think that now I come back and I see little American flags on the antenna of the car. They're getting ready for war. So I think probably Lyndon Johnson is simply an agent of nature. That the empire is getting to a point that there's going to be a blow-up, which is to say overpopulation, the ecological balance of the planet is upset, the food supply is in danger. I think there is war coming.
This is a recurrent phenomenon. People like to sort of massage their world weariness and tell us how everything is going for dogs. And there's a curious coincidence about the fact that it's always going to the dogs because we don't do what they tell us to do.
Now, I think probably Lyndon Johnson is simply an agent of nature. That the empire is getting to a point that there's going to be a blow-up, which is to say, overpopulation, the ecological balance of the planet is upset, the food supply is in danger. I think there is war coming.
This is a recurrent phenomenon. People like to sort of massage their world weariness and tell us how everything is going to the dogs. And there's a curious coincidence about the fact that it's always going for dogs because we don't do what they tell us to do. Now, I don't know how robust America is, but I'm sure it's robust enough to survive crises in the future. I don't remember any time during the past 20 years when we haven't heard the scare talk. America has about 6 months left to go. The answer is that we have, I think, more than that left to go. So I do think that there are signs to worry about, but a collection of that kind of syndrome is there. Not in the Democratic platform of tonight.
I must say, 6 months ago, Richard Nixon was the last person to do that in the 1956 election. He said, "We have 1 month to save America," said Richard Nixon.
And we saved it, didn't we?
We got Eisenhower, whom you highly disapproved of. You thought he was...
Well, how do you know we wouldn't have saved it if we hadn't voted for Eisenhower?
I did. Were we saved? No, I don't.
Let me ask you about another part of the Democratic platform, which isn't being debated. The Democrats are in favor of law and justice, where the Republicans are in favor of law and order. Is there any distinction?
Well, there is. There is a metaphysical distinction, which I'm sure has not been observed by the people who formulated the policies. A state as defined in the liberal idea is not a state which accepts justice as its primary goal, for the reason that elementary distinctions were made millennia ago between the city of God and the city of man. Now, I grant that the rhetoric of the Democratic Party sometimes seems to give us the impression that it is ushering in the city of God, except that God is unconstitutional. Given that, it seems to be trying to go in that direction. The Republican emphasis on law and order is, in my judgment, perhaps for accidental reasons, in closer congruity to the limited aspirations of a constitution of a free republic.
I think Mr. Buckley has very fairly stated, as usual, the viewpoint of the Daughters of the American Revolution. In actual fact, the Democratic Party is a little bit ahead of the Republican Party on this particular issue, but the metaphysical point, as Mr. Buckley would say, really is between what do you think about having a strong federal government as opposed to a strong local government? And this is a legitimate and a continuing debate. I would only give you this reminder that without a strong federal government, no school would have even begun to be integrated in the South. There never would have been a pure drug and food act. While we were down there in Miami, I noticed that the Florida Power and Light Company was going to put an atomic reactor in Biscayne Bay, which would have cooked all the fish. Now, the local Chamber of Commerce was a marvelous idea, because anything for money. And the Department of the Interior stopped it. Now, Mr. Buckley, with his laissez-faire love of doing business in the United States, anything that makes money has to be a good, that's American, would probably have allowed this. I say that the federal government must act in certain great issues.
Did you follow that one, Smith? Do you believe
that? That sounds like one of those orators out there.
However, I was transcribed and studied it.
No, I think...
I'm in favor of killing sharks in Biscayne Bay for profit, is that right?
No, but your Bill, let me tell you, your people are. And the terrible thing about it is that absolutely nothing would ever be done at a local level on something like integrated. You think there would be one integrated school in the South without the Supreme Court decision?
Well, before we had a strong central government, we had a civil war, the purpose of which was to free the slaves.